Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. Today is Tuesday, July 13th, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free at whyagain.org. If you go to that page and click on the Start Here logo in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. It's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 17 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and turning any negative emotional experience into part of that infallible guidance system that each of us have been given. You can also download the worksheet itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click on it, download it, print it off, and use it as often as you'd like. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness and get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon and Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one where people have been stepped through the worksheet process and or given testimonials about how the actual application of that tool has resulted in positive benefits in their life. We hope you do that soon and often because that usually leads to questions or comments or testimonials, and then you can call us at 563-999-3581 and press 1, and it'll put a little question mark by your phone number, and I'll answer it, and we'll have a discussion. We're also doing the Course in Miracles lessons from the workbook this year. Today is the 194th day of the year, and so today's lesson reads, I place the future in the hands of the Creator. Today's idea takes another step toward quick salvation, and a giant stride it is indeed. So great the distance is that it encompasses. It sets you down just short of heaven. With the goal in sight, and obstacles behind. Your foot has reached the lawns that welcome you to heaven's gate, the quiet place of peace where you await with certainty the final step of the Creator. How far we are progressing from the earth. How close are we approaching to our goal? How short the journey still to be pursued? If you accept today's idea and you have passed all anxiety, all pits of hell, all blackness of depression, thoughts of sin and devastation that are brought about by guilt. If you accept today's idea, you've released the world from all imprisonment and loosening the heavy chains that locked the door to freedom on it. You are saved, and your salvation thus becomes the gift you give the world. Paragraph 6 in this extensive commentary reads, If you can see the lesson for today as the deliverance it really is, you will not hesitate to give it as much consistent effort as you possibly can to make it be a part of you. As it becomes a thought that rules your mind, a habit in your problem-solving repertoire, a way of quick reaction to temptation, you extend your learning to the world. And as you learn to see salvation in all things, so will the world perceive that it is saved. So today's lesson is, I place the future in the hands of the creation. Pam Grout's Course in Miracles experiment, lesson 194, is titled, Blame It on the Boogie. She quotes Ben Aukrey as saying, beware the stories you read or tell. Beneath the waters of consciousness, they are altering your world. Pam writes, kids' computer games have undoubtedly evolved since my daughter Taz played them on the giant desktop. That early gateway was a veritable behemoth in my office. Back then, she had several games where, by pointing a cursor at an item in a scene, it would come alive. For example, if she clicked on a cupboard door, it would open, music would play, and a duet of dancing mice would pirouette across the shelf. Or she would click on a flower pot, and it would shimmy and shake until its beautiful red petals rained to the ground. Life is like those old computer games. When you put your attention on something, it literally comes alive. If you put your cursor on all the opportunities and love in the scenes of your life, that reality comes alive. But if you continue to click on the monsters under the bed, they too are more than happy to put on an appearance. The thing is, we're the ones in charge. We are the ones who decide where to point our cursors, where to send our attention. Lesson 194 asks me to point my cursor on a happy future, to relinquish the past. No more do I permit yesterday's woes to punish me. No longer do I see the world as my enemy. I rest untroubled, recognizing that life is limitless, abundant, and strangely accommodating. So, the Course in Miracles, lesson 194 from the workbook, I place the future in the hands of the Creator, in the hands of creation. Our call-in number is 563-999-3581. If you press that, call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. How can I support you today? I would add to our Course in Miracles lesson the idea that Bertrand Russell has a list of 10 commandments for critical thinking. They might be worth paying some attention to. Number one is, well, his introductory paragraph is, perhaps the essence of liberal outlook could be summed up in a new decalogue, not intended to replace the old one, but to supplement it. The 10 commandments that as a teacher I should wish to promulgate might be set forth as follows. Commandment number one, do not feel absolutely certain of anything. Well, to state it in a proactive way, question everything. Learn to live in the question, as Rilke would call us to do. Rule number two, do not think it worthwhile to proceed by concealing evidence, for the evidence is sure to come to light. So don't do things halfway and don't tell a half-truth to get your point across or manipulate somebody. Think of, speak from, and act from the whole truth as best you can. Commandment number three, never try to discourage thinking, for you are sure to succeed. Commandment number four, when you meet with opposition, even if it should be from your own husband, your children, endeavor to overcome it by argument and not by authority. for victory dependent on authority is unreal and illusory. Number five, have no respect for the authority of others, for there are always contrary authorities to be found. Number six, do not use power to suppress opinions that you think pernicious, for if you do, the opinions will suppress you. Number seven, do not fear to be eccentric in opinion, for every opinion now accepted was once eccentric. Number eight, find more pleasure in intelligent dissent than in passive agreement. For if you value intelligence as you should, intelligent dissent implies a deeper agreement than passive agreement. Number nine, be scrupulously truthful, even if the truth is inconvenient, for it is more inconvenient when you try to conceal it. And number 10, do not feel envious of the happiness of those who live in a fool's paradise, for only a fool will think that that is happiness. So, there's also the writing that I came across from Marcus Aurelius about a Stoic's key to peace of mind. Maria Popova writes in a Brain Pickings article, there are more things likely to frighten us than there are to crush us. We suffer more often in imagination than in reality. The truth is we know so little about life, and we don't really know what the good news is and what the bad news is. Kurt Vonnegut observed this in discussing Hamlet during his influential lecture on the shapes of stories. The whole process of nature is an integrated process of immense complexity, and it's really impossible to tell whether anything that happens in it is good or bad. Alan Watts wrote a generation earlier in his sobering case for learning not to think in terms of gain or loss. And yet most of us spend swaths of our days worrying about the prospect of events we judge to be negative, whether it's potential losses driven by what we perceive to be bad news. In the 1930s, one pastor itemized anxiety into five categories of worries, four of which are imaginary, and the fifth, quote, worries that have a real foundation, close quotes, which occupy perhaps 8% of the total. There's a 24-hour news cycle that preys on this human propensity, has undoubtedly, undeniably aggravated the problem and swelled that 8% to appear as though it's 98%. But at the heart of this warping of reality is an ancient tendency of mind that is so hardwired into our psyche that it exists independently of external events. The great first century Roman philosopher Seneca examined it, and its only real antidote, in his Letters from a Stoic. It's a timeless trove of wisdom that gave us Seneca on true and false friendship and the mental discipline of overcoming fear. In his 13th letter titled On Groundless Fears, Seneca writes, there are more things likely to frighten us than there are to crush us. We suffer more in imagination than in reality. And with an eye to the self-defeating and wearying human habit of bracing ourselves for imaginary disaster, Seneca counsels his young friend, quote, what I advise you to do is not to be unhappy before the crisis comes, since it may be that dangers before which you paled as if they were threatening you may never come upon you, and they certainly have not come yet. Accordingly, some things torment us more than they ought. Some torment us before they ought to, and some torment us when they ought not torment us at all. We are in the habit of exaggerating or imagining or anticipating sorrow. So taking all of this into consideration, whenever I have a thought, this is part of the bottom line observations, whenever I have a negative thought about myself or somebody else or a negative emotion active in my mind, I can instantly know three things. The first one is it's a lie or based on a falsehood. The next one is it's an old tape playing. It's not about the present moment. It's from my past. And the third thing is, if I take an action from a negative thought or negative emotion, I'm going to be adding negative emotional energy to my life, to the moment. And it can't do anything but make it worse. It's not possible for my life to get better once I've poured negative emotional energy into the situation or acted from a negative emotional state. So if I'm worrying about something that hasn't happened yet, I'm pouring negative emotional energy into my mind, into the moment, and if I take an action from it, I'm going to be acting from a negative emotional state. And the core of this work has me observe over and over again, in various ways, Dr. Rice has stated it in his worksheets, if I'm in pain, I'm in error. If I'm in pain, my thoughts are in error. And my true nature is the energy of light, the energy of love, the energy of creation. And if I act after tapping into that awareness of my true nature, it can only be positive and productive. If I act before I've tapped into awareness of my true nature, I can act from the negative. I can be adding negative emotional energy to my life. So if I'm willing to use the tools that are available in a place like the whyagain.org website, if I'm willing to come back to basics over and over again, I can literally transform my experience of life because I can make a decision, I can make a choice in the moment to only act from the positive, to see the truth as the truth, to see the false masquerading as the truth, as Krishnamurti would call me to, and to refuse to act until I have corrected my perception. How can I know my perception needs correcting? If I have a negative thought or a negative emotion active in my mind, that's the acid test. That's the one way to know for certain that what I'm perceiving, that the data points I'm using to create my perception or my picture of the world are coming from corrupt data. And if I'm willing to just continually come back to, okay, do I like how I'm feeling? If it's a negative thought or a negative emotion, I won't like how I'm feeling. I'm not called to say I'm wrong and everybody else is right. I am, however, called to understand whether or not I like how I'm feeling. And if I don't like how I'm feeling, then I'm encouraged to ask to be shown from something outside my conscious logical mind. This is not something I can figure out. Ask to be shown how to see it differently. Hoping against hope, there's a different way for me to look at my life, my world situation, and the interpretation that I have downloaded about this particular situation. If I'm willing to do that, and I'm willing to be persistent and consistent in that approach, I can get a new perspective. I can get new eyes to see and new ears to hear. And that's what we're after in this work. We're after the change that sustains us. We're after what we cannot get from our conscious logical mind, because it is, like Guy Finley talks about it as, a mechanical level of mind. It just keeps churning away, and it believes that it's right and that its perception is accurate, despite the fact that what it's choosing as a perception is causing it pain. So we are in a pattern of operating in a cycle that produces pain and suffering and then tries to convince us we didn't produce it by talking to us about how much we hate or dislike the pain and suffering we're in. And the best option I have for that, and the best option I've discovered in 47 years of doing therapy, is to open myself to ask to be shown something that my conscious logical mind cannot show me. To be willing to look again, to be willing to ask to be shown, to be willing to live in the question without demanding an answer, and to stay in that open space of questioning long enough that I can actually have a shift in my perception. And it's the kind of thing that's potentially available every time I do a worksheet. It's potentially available. It doesn't happen every time I do a worksheet. Why? Well, because, you know, I can talk about being willing. I had somebody in my office earlier today, and he was trying to tell me that, well, what's really needed is for me to be willing. And I said, that's one of the ingredients that's needed. But I need to be willing, and I need to continually engage the use of the tools, coming back to basics, canceling my goal, awakening to the fact that even if I feel emotionally calm, if I keep having negative thoughts or I keep having ruminating thoughts about a situation and I think, oh, I'm calm, I'm fine with how it went. But if I keep thinking about it 2 or 3 hours later, 2 or 3 days later, chances are really good somewhere in my consciousness, I'm not so calm. Somewhere in my consciousness, there's a negative belief, a negative emotional state driving this recurring thought. So I need to be willing to keep doing worksheets and canceling my goal. I need to be willing to keep going back to the breath. I need to be willing to be continually asking to be shown a new way to look at my life's circumstance. I need to be willing to do targeted journaling that Michael calls the mind shifter tool. I need to be willing to stay open rather than knowing, because my knowing is a judgment. And the knowing that I'm right and the other person's wrong when I'm still in any level of discomfort is a trap. It is me being blind. And I can say, well, I'm willing, and I need to be willing. But if it doesn't resolve, I need to not just be willing to see what might be revealed. I need to be willing to keep coming back to basics, to continually use a tool. A tool like, you know, Byron Katie's worksheet or Michael Rice's worksheet or the Ho'oponopono or, you know, the process of the six-step choose-again process that Diedrich Wolzak promotes. I need to continually come back to do the basics of questioning everything I think I know. And, you know, as the first commandment from Bertrand Russell says, do not feel absolutely certain of anything. Question everything. And in the questioning of everything, I include being willing to cancel whatever my mind is telling me needs to happen in order for me to be happy or safe. I need to be willing to start fresh. I need to be willing to cancel everything my mind is telling me that it knows needs to happen for me to be happy, for me to be safe, for me to be fulfilled, etc. And in that repeated use of the tools with willingness, I open myself to possibilities that I can't get any other way. There's no way I'm going to think my way into a solution to a problem that as I keep thinking about it, it gets more intense or my emotions get more intensely negative. So we're here to support people in the use of these tools. We're here to support people in exploring all the various tools that are available. And we'd be happy to entertain your comments or your questions. 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, it'll put a little question mark by your phone number, and I'll announce you by your area code. How can we support you today? What's on your mind? What about today's Course in Miracles lesson or any of the reading I've done sparks a thought in you? 563-999-3581. And as I mentioned yesterday, the second hour today will be a replay. Michael and Jeannie are busy with family. The replay will be perception, thoughts, feelings, and emotions. It's a previous show with that title, so feel free to stay tuned for that. I believe Michael and Jeannie will be back again live tomorrow. And we have time for a question or comment. How can we support you? What's on your mind? What about the Course in Miracles lessons so far strikes you? The thing that was striking me so powerfully in the past few days of the Course in Miracles lessons is these lessons at their core are designed to get us to entertain almost exactly the opposite of what our culture teaches us. Our culture teaches us that our conscious logical mind and our thought process is our best tool for solving any upset. But the Course in Miracles lessons over and over again are asking us to practice giving that up. And today's lesson in particular, I place the future in the hands of love, in the hands of creation. Well, especially in our Western culture, we're basically conditioned to the opposite of that. We're conditioned to strive, to set goals and achieve them, to struggle, to work hard, put our nose to the grindstone. And as I read in the sixth paragraph of that commentary for today's lesson, it says, if you can see the lesson for today as this complete deliverance that it really is, then you will give as much consistent effort to it as you possibly can and make it a part of you. Well, our Western culture doesn't teach us to surrender. Our Western culture teaches us to strive, to work hard, to work long, to fight for, you know, quote, what is right, etc. And so this is everything about the Course in Miracles lessons is basically asking us to question and eventually break away from everything our culture would tell us is so critically important, and to propose a different process for finding solutions to our problems. And that process is one of questioning and asking rather than digging and arguing and rationalizing. It's a process of using our emotions in an entirely different way. You know, my culture teaches me that my emotions are there to let me know something's wrong. But the culture insists that the thing that's wrong must be outside of me. When I'm angry, I have a right to be angry, and I should use my anger in this way or that way. But basically, use it as I'm focused on the world outside of me, as though the world outside of me is responsible for my anger. And that if I'm powerful enough and loud enough and persistent enough to get people and things outside of me to change, then I won't have to feel my anger anymore. And everything about these Course in Miracles lessons is designed to get us to turn inward when there's a negative emotion, rather than focusing on the outside world. Is this Ellen?
Yes, it is. Hi, Dr. Tim.
Welcome, Ellen.
Thank you. I just wanted to
say,
I just totally agree with these Course in Miracles lessons. They've just been so powerful. And I especially love today's lesson. It's so funny because last night when I went to bed, I was thinking about how much I have changed as far as being a person who plans everything to now I am so much enjoying not planning and just watching to see what's going to happen. It's so much more exciting. Plus, I don't set myself up for disappointment when my plans don't go as I had planned them. And for the first time in my life, like, I'm thinking about possibly taking a trip. I mean, I was invited to go on a trip. And unlike the other people that are going, I'm making no arrangements. And because I don't really know for sure if I'm going to go. And I thought, well, I don't really have to make arrangements. I mean, I can wait to book a hotel room. And nothing else, like they're buying advance tickets for other events and things like that. And I'm like, well, if I'm meant to go to that event, I'll get a ticket. And if not, there's other things I can do. So I've just decided, and I really am just loving the idea of wondering what's going to happen. Am I going to go? Am I not going to go? If I go, where am I going to stay? What am I going to do? And it's like kind of very exciting not knowing, which is so totally different than the way I used to be. Everything had to be planned out. I mean, everything. And I'm finding it just refreshing. And, you know, even just little things like going for a walk, you know, I used to plan the route I was going to take. And now I'm like, okay, now I've been shown that my body gets guided. If I slow down and stay in the moment, I can feel the way I'm being guided to go. So that's what I do now. And it's the same sort of like, oh, what way is it going to be today? You know, I don't know. And it's much more fun that way for me. Because I used to do like the same walk over and over and over again. And now I don't know. And the other night I was walking and I actually went into a fear state because there was a man walking towards me. Well, I went off the path because there was something about a tree that I wanted to look at closer up. So I was off the path looking at the leaves on this tree. And then I heard the man that had been coming my direction, he started making like all these guttural noises. And I immediately went into fear because I had an experience about a year and a half with a man who is clearly mentally imbalanced. And he ended up attacking me. So, you know, this was first thing that pops into my mind, of course, right? So I was just like, okay, it's okay. Just, you know, you're not even on the path. Just stay where you're at and everything will be fine. And he went by me. And after he went by me, he just started letting out wails. And I was like, oh, my God. You know, and I saw myself in him as a child, and which was so interesting because the prior experience I had with the man that ended up attacking me was, it was his rage. And I saw my rage in him. I mean, he was so angry. And I was like, oh, my God, that's how I was. You know, that's how I was. And it's obviously still there, or else I wouldn't have had that experience. So, but this time I'm seeing, like, the wailing, which is, like, what I was seeing is, like, underneath. Underneath the rage is that just such a deep, deep hurt. So I thought it was very interesting that it seemed to be an indication that, okay, now I'm getting down to the level of where this can be processed, because I could never do anything with my anger. I would feel it and whatever, and but it would never lessen. And I realized it's because it's not the anger. It's what's underneath the anger that needs to be processed. The anger is just a cover for it. So anyway, I got to, like, I was in the exact same situation as I was the last time that this happened with this man that attacked me, in that in order to get back to where my car was parked, there was a very good chance I would meet him again, because we were going in opposite directions, and it's like a loop. And then there's parts, too, where you can't even get off the path. Just because of the terrain. And so there's this part of me that's still, like, afraid, like, oh, no, oh, no. And then I had an out, because I could have gone across the bridge and got started going the same direction he was going, or the same, you know, the same side of the stream that he was on, and I wouldn't have had the chance of meeting up with him again. But I was like, no, I'm going to do what I always do. It happened to be right at that spot where I was first shown, like, the guidance as far as my body's guidance of which way to go. And I was like, I'm going to do what I always do. I'm going to allow my guidance to show me which way to go. I'm not going to say, oh, I'm going to go that way because my fear wants me to go that way. And so sure enough, it was like, no, my body wanted me to go the way that I was afraid of going. And so I was like, okay, you know, I know I'm safe, but there's still that fear in my body. So it turns out that I did end up meeting him again, but it was like nothing like I had imagined, where I would be alone in a place where, like, I could be attacked. It was like around people, and everything was fine, and it was no issue at all. But I guess my whole point is that when we put the future in the hands of God, you know, like when we just say, no, I'm going to refuse to buy into what, you know, my fearful thoughts are telling me, and just allow myself to be guided, then I know I'm going to be safe. And
well,
that's exactly,
it's certainly worth a try.
Know,
right, and then unfortunately, your experience proves it out, and that's what we're called to do more and more, is understand that there is this very small band of our life experience that requires a fear response. Very small, and that's that immediate, you know, life or death, fight or flight response. And the vast majority of our life, as David E. Martin would call us to pay attention to, is monotonously good and safe. You know, the vast majority of moments in our lives, we're not getting mugged. There isn't a tornado coming at our house. Right? The economy isn't crashing. The vast majority of moments in our lives are monotonously good. And if we can understand how much suffering we put ourselves through by fearing and resisting the flow of life rather than going with it, it transforms everything. And that's what these Course in Miracles lessons are calling us to do, to mm-hmm. fundamentally challenge everything we've come to believe from our culture. So, glad it's working for you.
Yeah. And everything. I mean, like, I don't know. I think a lot about, like, all of the care and concern we give to our bodies. And, you know, the Course teaches that if we just left the body to itself, you know what I mean? If we didn't get all wrapped up in all that, the body would be perfectly fine. And, you know, I used to be a very, well, I used to be a runner, and then after I had started having knee problems, I became a walker, but a very fast walker, not only because I thought it was better exercise, but I just grew up with a father who walked really fast. We all just, we had to practically run to, you know, keep up with him, and we just, that was just our habit. And it wasn't until I was kind of forced to slow down that I realized how much I was missing. How much I was missing when I was walking so fast. And now I actually, not only do I walk slowly, but I do a lot of standing still and just observing. And it's so much more enjoyable now when I go for a walk than it used to be, when it was really more about exercise than anything else. And it's because I gave up this idea that I have to get, like, a certain amount of exercise, or it has to be this way, you know, it'll be better if I do it this way. You know, I just decided to give up all that nonsense that we're taught. You know, free myself from that, and things just got so much better. But it's not
glad to
easy
hear it.
Because it's so,
well, yeah,
you know,
there's an old habit to break.
Yeah.
And sometimes those habits have years, if not decades, of practice. And what the neuroscientists mm-hmm. tell us is that with that constant repetition, it literally develops pathways, neural pathways that are, you know, they're habitual and they're well-practiced, and so they fire almost instantaneously any time any associated thought gets triggered. And so I might have, you know, dozens and dozens of thoughts that have become associated with my fear response, or with my doom and gloom response, or with my avoidance response. And so I need to be willing to apply the tools over and over again, dozens and dozens of times, until those connections are basically put on extinction, right? The conditioned response continues and gets stronger the more it's paired with the unconditioned response. And I need to put it on extinction. I need to be willing to have that thought, oh, you better run, and then engage the breath and centering and learn the difference between that habitual conditioned response and my true inner knowing. And understand, you know, one of the people often say, well, how do you know the difference? I say, well, for me, one of the things that's taken my work to the next level is the realization that when it's that true inner knowing, there's a calm energy mm-hmm. to it. There's a grounded certainty that just, I have no, I'm not in rage, I'm not in fear, I'm not in confusion, I'm just calm. So that's one of the tools I use. I use the breath to get centered, and I ask. And if I feel myself having this urge to take a direct action, I usually take the action. But there's a calmness that goes with that urge or that direction that isn't panic.
Right. And that's one of the things that I noticed. It was like, in order for me to get the guidance, like twice, not even happened again today. It was like I was just, you know, at a again, old habits starting to pick up my pace. And then it was like, I just feel like all of a sudden it was like I was walking into, like, I don't know, molasses. It was like, oh, yeah, I'm getting to one of these choice points. It's like, slow down so you can get the guidance. And it was like, it's just, you know, I can just see how when I'm moving quickly, and especially if I'm, like, in my mind, there's no way I'm gonna feel the guidance. That's always right there. But if I slow down, get myself present, then it's so obvious. And the more that I practice doing this, the stronger it gets. I mean, I'll sometimes, like, way before I'm even getting to a choice point, I'll feel my body starting to be pulled in a certain direction strongly. Today I was like, I was almost like having to force myself to stay on the path because I was feeling the pull so strongly to go in a certain direction. And it's like, wow, it just keeps getting stronger and stronger the more that I am willing to just do that. And instead of, like, making my own decisions, following the guidance.
Well, keep practicing.
Yeah.
And practicing the listening, practicing the asking.
Yes. Yeah,
well,
I've gotten
any other
myself
thoughts or comments?
I was just going to say, I've gotten myself into the practice now of anytime I find myself judging someone, just asking to be shown, how am I, you know, show me my oneness with this person. How am I one with this person? And I've been having really good results with that. Something opens up and I see how exactly what, you know, like they're doing that was bothering me is something that I had judged myself for before. And it's really, that's what I was saying about, I don't know if it was yesterday or the day before I was on with Susan and I. And it's just like the judgment just disappears when you recognize, oh, yeah, that was me. And now I'm seeing it in them and judging it. So funny.
Well, that's it. You know, there's that the bottom line observation that is on my list. It says, I will never be upset about anything anybody else ever says or does or doesn't do that I think they should, unless I'm still judging myself negatively for doing the same or similar thing. It's just never going to happen. And I had somebody in my office earlier today, and he was saying, no, wait a minute. You know, I don't do that. And I said, yeah, you may not be doing it now, but did you used to when you were a teen, when you were a preteen, when you were a young adult? And he groaned, literally groaned, because, yeah. He was the king of this, that, or the other impatience or gossip or rudeness that is currently what he thinks is upsetting him in somebody else's behavior. And so we talked about how if he's willing to look at, you know, the times in his life that he remembers doing that, that he still judges himself negatively, and go back and do worksheets or EFT tapping on that or the targeted journaling that Michael calls a mind shifter, and uncover the ways in which he's still judging himself negatively, and uncover what was the actuality of his life back then, what were the limitations of his understanding and his resources. And when he comes to understand, oh, I was just doing the best I could, I was in a tremendous amount of fear or pain at that time, or I had a complete lack of understanding about relationships and the future. And when he comes to understand that and dismantle the negative judgments against himself for having done those things in the past, he will have completely dismantled his negative judgment of the other person in the present moment. And when he looks at them, he'll see them in a completely different light.
Exactly. Because he'll see himself in them. And it's like, before it was like, oh, I don't do that. you know, that person's totally different than I am. But then in the end, when you see that, oh, yeah, okay, I know exactly how they feel,
yeah,
or where they're coming from.
Yeah. Guy Finley says, the way you open up compassion is when you start exploring with complete honesty, and you finally realize that you're, at various times in your life, you're completely unable to keep yourself from doing the very thing that you think you're angry at this other person for doing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It's just another rephrasing of your finding that we're all the same, right? That I am them and they are me. And so the idea is,
right,
I need to be willing, again, here's the theme for today, just to come back to the basics. I need to be willing to do an infinite number of worksheets on an issue like that until it feels complete. And that, you know, that will invariably get old from time to time. It will invariably feel like this isn't working. I've done this before. I've done these worksheets. I've done this processing. I've done this journaling. And what's needed is my willingness to continue to do what has worked in the past with openness, because maybe, you know, maybe it's time to stop doing worksheets and try something else.
Mm-hmm.
I need to have a level of willingness that surpasses what level of willingness I had last week or last year.
Mm-hmm.
And again, one of the things that I find so useful is finding increasing ways to be more gentle with myself, because
mm-hmm.
judgment is counterproductive. Judgment keeps me locked in the prison.
Exactly.
Knowing
I'm
right
that.
And the other person's wrong is just a dead end.
Yeah, I love that
what
part. I think
say?
It was in yesterday's. I love that part. I think it was in yesterday's lesson, and I know it's also in the text, and of course in Miracles, where he talks about how the jailer is just as much in prison as his prisoner, because he has to keep watch over him.
Exactly.
And it's so true. It's like you can't be free unless you let everyone else be free. And, you know, that's why
true.
I see my, you know, my habit of, like, suspicion and, like, oh, I better keep an eye out, and it's like, oh my God, there, you know. And then I just say, okay, I can just let that go. It's an old habit, and I want to free myself, you know. And it's just a beautiful thing when you get to, like, what you were talking about before, how you see that whatever it was that you know you judged yourself for. And now it's like, you know, in your unconscious, but now you're seeing it like someone else is doing it. When you go back and look at it, it always comes from a place of innocence. Always.
Because that's your essence.
Yeah. And it's
that's
like,
where we
oh,
started,
I
and,
see.
And it's the place we've never left.
Yeah.
Right? That's that old spiritual journey thing that once you realize, when you reach your destination, you realize you never went anywhere, that the beginning is the end, that it's all about misperception.
Exactly.
When it comes to negative thoughts and emotions, it's all about my perceptual process being faulty, not about the world being faulty.
Right.
It's that Marcus Aurelius thing about saying, you know, how we have this violent clash between our expectations and the actuality of life. And what's needed is not a way to change the actuality of life, but to adjust our expectations. And that's the solution. That's the way to peace. That's the way to comfort.
Yeah, and that's why today's lesson is, I mean, is so perfect because it's you just let go of whatever expectation, you know, that you might be having. And, you know, when you look at things and say, well, you know, this could happen or that could happen, and if you really see that, you're fine either way. Maybe you secretly hope that this will happen. But when you realize it doesn't really, in the end, it doesn't matter what happens, because I'm fine no matter what happens, then it's like, well, how can I ever be upset? I don't know.
Well, I can be upset. Yeah, I can be upset in any moment when I'm not willing to accept what is. I can choose or have that, as Michael Rice would say, that automatic decision process kick in to create upset again. But it's all an inside job, right? There's the realization. My upset is all an inside job.
Yeah. And if we keep an open mind, like I'm doing, like with this trip, I mean, it will not affect me one way or the other whether I go or I don't go, because I'm not setting myself up for disappointment by thinking, you know, that this is what's going to happen and planning it out like that. I'm just allowing myself to be open to whatever happens and living in the excitement of not knowing. It's such a new way of living for me. I know a lot of people are, you know, I always admired people that were spontaneous, and I just was not that kind of a person. And I'm discovering the beauty of it. And just allowing whatever is going to come is going to come, and knowing, you know, deep in my heart that it's perfect. It's better than I ever could have planned it, because that's what I keep being shown. When I stop the planning, things happen that I never could have planned. So much better.
Yeah, many of us find the same thing. And and one of the best skills I ever developed was the willingness to be patient, to put aside what I think I want and my upset when it didn't go the way I wanted, and watch, because it's going to unfold differently and better than I ever could have imagined. And that's not the way I was taught, but it is what I have learned over the years with maturity and practice. Well, I realize that we're down to our last minute and a half, so I thank you for the call and commentary, and I will mute you so we can do a quick transition and start up the second half. Today will be on perception, thought, feelings, and emotions. So thank you, Ellen. Have a blessed
thank
day.
Thank you, Dr. You too.
I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. My assumption is Michael and Jeannie will be back again tomorrow, and here is a pre-recorded hour on perception, thought, feelings, and emotions. Blessings.
If you're not familiar with our show, you can go to our website, which is www.whyagain.org, and there is a ton of information out there. There's audios, videos, there's downloads of the book in about 8 different languages, the commitment, the worksheets, everything is out there for free download. And then the radio show is here to support you. If you start doing worksheets or looking at the work and you have questions, something you don't understand, then call into the show and press 1 and ask your question, because I guarantee if you have a question, it's also someone else's question too. And so, Michael, are you back yet? Apparently not.
I am
going to assume. Oh, there you are. Welcome.
I am. Thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. We're honored that you're with us today and ready to step into the next level of awakening from the sleep of the non-being mind. You know, in this work, we're looking at 2 different states of expression that are possible for us as humans. One of those states is a true human life, and we define a true human life experientially. And the experience that will give you a taste of what human life is holding the newborn child. When you hold that newborn, you get the experience of what we are designed to live as. And then there's the state of non-being, which is really a state of hypnosis. You know, in the ancient teachings, the master said transcend. They were saying put an end to the state of trance. Get out of hypnosis and wake up to who you are. And when you wake up to who you are, you will flood your physiology with neuropeptides based in love. And that will in a whole different state of being from the average person today. The state of hypnosis that we can be put into is pretty awesome when you realize it. I was speaking to someone yesterday and suggested that we might go in and present at a military base they were working at. And the response was, oh, no, they wouldn't let you on there. They won't let anyone touch the emotions of these men and women because they represent such a deep investment in a particular state of mind that they won't even allow me as a psychologist to tinker with their state of mind. And it's just interesting to see how deeply hypnotized people can become so that the profane becomes normal and the insane seems like a rational way to function. We see that on the national stage today as people are, you know, making the most bizarre pronouncements as though this is what leadership of the world looks like. And it's just really crazy. We didn't get to hear from Dr. Tim yesterday, but Tim, I did finally get to watch that video that you shared about from the TED Talk where this gentleman's talking about people living in their hallucinations. And I was particularly, you know, if you're there, I don't know for sure, but we'll find out in a minute. But I was particularly interested in the experiment that they did, and they show this experiment where they have a person sitting in a chair, and they have them with their right hand on a table, and they have the left hand on the table, but hidden from view by a little wall. So this person can't see their own left hand. And then they put a fake hand on the table. And the person in front of them is sitting in front of them and stroking their real hand and the fake hand. So the hand that's hidden in view is being stroked by the experimenter, just being touched, just being brushed, and the fake hand is being brushed at the same time. And then someone comes up with a knife to stab the fake hand. And the person in the experiment is so convinced that the fake hand is their hand, even though they're sitting there knowing that their own hand is there out of view, that they instantly draw their real hand away from the knife as though they're drawing, as though the fake hand were their hand. I mean, it was just a really interesting portrayal to me of the depth of hypnosis that one can be put into. Now, they don't tell us exactly how long that stroking took place. From the experiment, it looked like it wasn't more than just a few seconds. It may have been a longer time that wasn't shown in the video, but whatever the time frame was, to get to the point of, like, I know this is a fake hand. I know my hand is over there on the other side of this wall where I can't see it, and yet I withdraw my hand because someone's stabbing the fake hand. I withdraw my real hand that the mind has been convinced that this hand that's being stabbed is their own. And to me, the implications of that are so profound for our culture and our world that when people are told something over and over and over and over and over again, that their minds produce perceptions as though those perceptions were of actuality and true. You know, it's said that Hitler's head propagandist said, if you make the lie big enough and you tell it often enough, no one will question it. Everybody will believe it. And it was just, to me, that experiment was one of the most profound parts. Of course, it was nice to hear this neurobiologist who's affirming everything we've been teaching for decades and saying, yeah, hey, our labs are starting to prove that Yeshua was right. That was pretty cool. Of course, he didn't say those words, but in essence, that's what he's doing. So Dr. Tim, any thoughts? Yesterday we didn't get to chat with you, and I think you maybe had some thoughts to share with us, but you were tied up and then we never got back to you. Any thoughts for us and any discussion on that particular, how that particular part of that video impacted you?
Well, I think, you know, the whole video is just lovely because there's...
It is.
Two different... Wait, are you there?
I am, yes.
All right. There's two different ways he's discussing how we create our perception. One is our perception of the outside world and events, and the other is we create a perception of ourselves and all of the relative sense of experience, of being, of belonging, of acting in the world. And so, you know, the first part he's talking about how our perception of the outside world is absolutely just best guesses, because the brain doesn't receive any light. The brain doesn't receive any sound. The brain doesn't receive any physical touch. All the brain receives is stimulation through these neural chemical pathways. And when it receives that stimulation, it has to make its best guess about what that stimulation means, where it's located, how it feels, etc. And so he says in the first part of the talk that the stimulation coming in through our senses is not as important as the beliefs and the best guess approximations we make about that in terms of creating our perception. And then, of course, he takes it to the next level and says, even our belief about who we are, where our body is, where it starts, where it ends, whether it's safe, is all guesses created by guessing about stimulation. And he said, in terms of creating my sense of self, the internal perceptions, that's all regulated by trying to maintain homeostasis and safety. And that's why this person is so easily deceived in the fake hand experiment, because it's this sense, my sense of my internal organs isn't that I know exactly where my heart is and what it's doing and where my liver is and what it's doing. I only become aware of my heart or my liver if I go into a deep meditation or if there's a problem there that's causing discomfort. And so my awareness of myself is about maintaining homeostasis and safety. And so when I see somebody stabbing something that's getting the same kind of stimulation that my hand is getting, even though they're not stabbing at my hand and I can't see my hand, I jerk back in a protective manner, because all of my sense of self, as they're studying it, is derived from that homeostasis and trying to maintain safety and security. And of course, what I like to tell people is, we have simply adopted, not adapted, not adjusted, not mediated, but simply taken the template that we use for survival in the wild and physical hurts and aches and pains, and just laid it completely over the emotional realm where it's not relevant. And we haven't done any adjustment. And so this is why when I start to feel anger or fear or sadness at an intense level, I might, if I haven't been trained into the fact that I'm the one creating that sensation, I might easily be misled to think something on the outside is causing it and literally be willing to go to war or literally attack somebody physically to try and end my internal pain because it was all derived from this internal sense of homeostasis and safety. So it makes really good sense about why we have people who aren't aware of the true nature of the origins of their pain and how they've misperceived it as a physical threat when simply it's a little bit of irritation or a little bit of sadness or a little bit of depression or a little bit of anger. And if it's been misperceived as a safety issue, why they would escalate all the way to physical violence. So that's my offering on that part.
Yes, why I think it's so powerful. Say again, Tim?
And why I think it's so important that you're doing what you're doing and trying to help people understand how it all works, and that they're not being threatened from the outside. Their pain is not being caused from the outside.
Right. And that by not resolving their pain, they can actually set up the energetic dynamics by spraying the energy of their pain out on people. They can actually set up the result that they're so afraid of, that they actually create that result. They do behaviors unconsciously. They move in the direction of whatever it takes to produce that result that they've been hypnotized into believing is inevitable. And then it becomes self-fulfilling prophecy because it becomes inevitable by their own behaviors and their actions and the energies that they're radiating out into the world. So it's so important to recognize that forgiveness is going inside of oneself and removing what never belonged. There's some other research that I've been looking at, and there's a little critter that's called a prairie vole. And it's kind of like a small mole-type creature. And this prairie mole is a creature that once it mates for life with the other vole that it mates with. And what they're finding is that there's a neurotransmitter. We've been talking more and more about how neurotransmitters or informational molecules are simply reflections of compressed thoughts. And so this vole mates, and they find that once it mates, there's an increase in oxytocin, and that oxytocin, they're suspecting, or they're starting to prove, is the thing that causes them to mate for life. And it is something that creates that kind of connection that keeps these two little creatures together for life and actually has them, you know, cooperatively building a nest and raising young and protecting each other. You know, all sorts of interesting behaviors go along with it. And there's another creature very close in relationship called a prairie vole. And the prairie vole doesn't do that same behavior. The prairie vole does not mate for life. If it gets an opportunity to mate, you know, male finds a female, it mates. It just mates, it mates, it mates, it mates. But interestingly enough, what they found is if they allow, and apparently the two voles, these two little creatures, have to be in each other's space for a certain period of time. It appears to be something like about 6 hours. And if they're in each other's space for 6 hours, and then they put an injection of oxytocin in the male, and they mate, then this prairie vole, which just never mates for life, all of a sudden mates for life. So, you know, you wonder what's contained in that informational molecule that makes a connection that says, I am now true to this relationship with this female, as opposed to I have no integrity in my relationships, and, you know, just the implications that has. And these states of hypnosis, you know, oftentimes people say, well, you know, a young man grows into maturity and the hormones start to rage. And what are hormones? Hormones are just thoughts. They're just compressed. You know, if you go to the opening words in the book of John where we're told it says, in the beginning was the Word and the Word became flesh, it doesn't say that. It says, in the beginning was the mind energy and the mind energy became flesh. So these hormones are simply compressed thoughts. And if one is repeatedly assaulted, and I use that word fairly consciously in this particular context, if a young man is repeatedly assaulted by a culture that says his job is to go out and mate with as many females as he can, not his job is to create relationship and a life based in love and a home and take care of children, then that neuropeptide they call hormone starts to rage, and, you know, results happen. And once again, it takes us back to the importance of forgiveness, because it is through forgiveness that we go inside ourselves at depth and create an increasingly intense ability or skill set of being able to go within ourselves and remove those things, those neuropeptides, those unconscious genetic thoughts tend to run our lives. You know, if generation after generation after generation of humans was, you know, promiscuous, and then there are neuropeptides, there are information molecules that tend to be passed. The energetic dynamics of that is passed on through the genes. And then when something resonates those genes, my take is that the activity, and I don't know what the scientists out of the laboratory would say about it, but the activity, the frequency of that gene coming into action is going to cause the proteins within our structure to assemble themselves in a certain way according to the pattern of the thoughts resonated out of the genes, and we're going to have the expression of a neuropeptide for either being true in relationship and having integrity and monogamy in relationship, or doing something different. And that many people are driven, or most of us are driven by whatever happens to be moving us, and whatever our heritage happens to be, if it moves, it runs us. And if it runs us and it's not like love, then we don't get to live out the truth of who we are, sourcing our thoughts, sourcing our lives from choice, from this presence of love that we are designed to be, and having thoughts that support that and bring that into expression so that we can create a culture, create a family system, create a community, create a way of thinking that is true to the truth of who we are as love and the natural behaviors that come along out of that expression of love. And so, you know, it's just building a bigger and bigger and bigger picture. And and listening to that gentleman's presentation was a really quite a delightful piece in the puzzle to hear that affirmation. And the more and more we learn about it, the more the ancient teachings from the first century Aramaic Yeshua become so clearly visible and so deeply genius in their roots, that if we uncover them and learn to use the tools that come with those teachings, that life becomes more fulfilling, more alive, more joyous. I ran into someone the other day here in in Asheville, where we're doing our workshops. By the way, if anybody is in the Asheville area, come join us tonight, tomorrow night, for two more free workshops in our series of five. And then, of course, Saturday we'll be doing Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing. But this was a person who had done some of my work 25 years ago in South Florida. And when I got into a conversation, you know, this is someone that had come to some of my workshops way back when, and I never heard from them again. And here we reconnect 25 years later, and this person said, you know, you don't know this about our meeting, but your work back 25 years ago saved my life. Now, I didn't ask, and it wasn't volunteered exactly what was happening, but it was a person who picked up the tools and put them to use and literally recognized that they changed the inclinations, the thought inclinations within them that, at least according to their assessment of their lives at that time, would have led to their death. And here they are now later, you know, 25 years later, thriving and enjoying life. So it's interesting when people run into the tools and you just never know. And that's one of the reasons why we keep suggesting start a support group, share the tools with somebody. You know, even the briefest exposure to the core of the forgiveness process can have such profound influences on someone's life. And here's what I know: when it has that profound an influence on someone's life, it's stored in their genes, and it becomes available to their whole bloodline. To me, that's the importance of the work that we're doing and why we're committed to making sure that it gets into the hands of every heart, mind, and being on the planet. So any other thoughts in that direction for you, Tim?
Well, my thoughts are about how in my own work recently, I was talking on the show on Monday, and then we talked a little bit about it on Tuesday, that I had been listening to the old archives, and in 2011, when the show first began, I shared some series of worksheets I'd done. And one of the things that happened when I listened to it again 6.5 years later is I got some new insights. And so we were talking about my dad and the power person dynamic and how when certain kinds of stress would come up for him, he would leave in one way or another. He would have a drink or he would go into the den to work or he would go to work. And so as I was listening to that series of shows over the weekend, I got another level of insight about his power person dynamic and the leaving. And the piece that was new to me, it wasn't new news, but I integrated it differently, was all of a sudden it popped into my head, oh my gosh, here's another way that his power person dynamic got started, because when my father was 9 years old, his father died of a heart attack. So his father's stress level went up, and his father did the ultimate leaving. He died. So that's how I come by this honestly, through the bloodline, just it's what happens. My power person had a power person who had a power person, etc. So I got that insight, and it was integrating with me. And then I realized I had a present-day dynamic going on where somebody wanted to engage with me, and instead of just saying no, I said, well, I'll think about it. And as I thought about it more and more, I realized I had an emotional hang-up about this. So I wasn't pulling the trigger to say, yes, okay, I'll move forward, and I wasn't saying, no, I'm done. So I started doing my own work on this. And yesterday morning, after some worksheets on Tuesday and reaching a different level of clarity, I had my friend do this energy work with me with is it's very parallel to the mind shifter, I'm sorry, the reality management wake-up sheet process, where I put aside all the logical stuff and just ask to be shown the hidden part of my mind that's creating this blockage or this upset. And what I saw in when I'm asking to be shown was myself dealing with my father when I was 4 years old, and that the difficulty my father had in dealing with loss and grief and abandonment that he came by naturally was part of what was resonating with me in the real world today as a 63-year-old thinking about dealing with somebody in a business deal, because that person has had horrible grief loss in recent times, and that energy is all over. That energy is triggers me, and my issues with being unable to fix and heal my father from 4 years old and on, and that level of insight left this clean and open space for me to start dealing with this adult today in a completely different fashion. And
powerful.
Understanding that as I move forward, I may get triggered, but now I know it's not about the interactions between me and this other adult. It's about my sensitivity to dealing with people who have unresolved grief issues and my own unresolved grief issues as a result of that. So for me, there's the benefit of putting my work out there to get other perspectives and opinions. There's the benefit of working in the support group. There's the benefit of having the radio show for input. And there's the benefit of reviewing the patterns that I've been through and understanding that if I was dealing with a pattern of an issue 5 years ago, it's very likely to raise its head again, and it's okay. It's just me getting it at a different level or a different flavor or a different variety, and I welcome the chance to resolve it at another level. So that's my offering.
Fabulous. And, of course, the beauty of doing each of those levels of work is each time you become more empowered to be the space for the healing of that kind of pain and grief. It's part of the process of being able to hold to that act of love that resolves those dynamics for yourself and for others. So it's a powerful way, you know, doing one's own work is a powerful way to be empowered to heal, as we talk about in our Empowered to Heal workshop.
Awesome.
Well,
we did have a caller.
All right.
I'll tell you what, let's go ahead. Let's take her call, Jean.
Area code 336, you're on the air. Is this Tracy?
Yes, it is. Hi, y'all.
Hey, welcome, young lady. Good to hear your voice.
Good to hear y'all. I was on yesterday, and Jeannie was talking about that movie, Inside Out, and she was explaining about words and emotions and thoughts, and then you had a distinction that you added, and you explained it. And I was wondering if you could explain it again, the difference. I wasn't clear. Using like an example from, let's say, like I'm irritated because I'm supposed to be on a call and my mom showed up unannounced, or, you know, some situation that would be like a real worksheet, and apply what you were explaining to like a real life situation. Or I also had the thought when Dr. Tim was talking, I also couldn't fix or save my father. And so that's a lot of worksheets that I've done, but that issue is still there. So that could be another one you could use, or you could just make one up. But I was wondering if you could take that explanation and put it into a real situation, because I kind of got lost in the wording of the intellectual aspect of it versus how you actually apply it in real life.
Well, the first thought that comes is that you might want to watch the movie Saving Mr. Banks.
Okay.
If you haven't seen it yet, or if it's been a while since you've seen it, it's very powerful. It's a true story of Walt Disney and what he went through with the author of the book, Mary Poppins, and what it took for him to make that movie. And it was all about, you know, saving Mr. Banks, which is the author's father. And it's a powerful, powerful place to open and process those emotions. And at this moment, I'm not quite sure, so if you could give me some more details about exactly what you're referring to that happened yesterday, if you could be more specific.
Can I jump in there on that?
Oh, please.
Yeah,
please,
Jeannie,
please,
maybe you can help, because I really
take
struggled to articulate it. I was trying to tell Julie, and I couldn't even say it very well. She's like, call in and ask Michael and Jeannie.
So I will say what I hear, and then Michael can clarify if I'm off of it again. What the gentleman was saying about the Inside Out was he was talking about how the emotions organize the thinking, and use the example of like sadness. You know, that when sadness would touch one of the memory balls, it would change the way that Riley processed, you know, what was going on in her life. And the refinement that Michael made was it was the thought behind the emotion. And so, for instance, the example that you're giving of that you were supposed to be talking to someone and your mom came in, was that what it was?
Right.
Okay, so if it were just emotions that changed the way you saw your world, then maybe you would say, well, my agitation came up or my frustration came up, and then that changed how I saw the whole situation with my mom. Really then what Michael was saying, it's the thought behind that frustration or that irritation. So it would be, you know, mom's timing is off, or, you know, I wish she would be more considerate, you know, when she comes in and I'm on a call or something like that. So it's the thought behind the emotion. The emotion is triggered by that thought. And so it's really the thought that organizes our thinking and the way that we see the world, not the emotion. So he just did that little refinement that they were the flip side of the same coin, but that you can't just try to address the emotion itself. You have to address the thought that's behind the emotion. Am I right on that, Michael?
You're right on track. And this points to, for me, the reason why you want to be as precise and specific as possible in the goal that you use when you're doing a worksheet, a wake-up sheet. So in this specific example that you and Jeannie have just been talking about, so there could be 100 different thoughts behind the emotion of whatever the upset or the irritation was. It might be, And each one would have each thought would have a different goal. So the irritation, a piece of mind energy, goes into the structure, turns into a neuropeptide, strikes a cell, and when it strikes a cell, it informs the cell the quality of the thought. So if the feeling is that of irritation, then what that feeling is telling you is that this thought, when you put it into your cellular structure, is an irritant to the cell and creates a diseased condition. And the thought might be, you know, why doesn't my mother ever honor me? I.e., you know, she just walks in my house anytime and doesn't inform me she's coming. So that might be the thought that you'd be doing the worksheet on. And so the goal would be, I want mom to honor me. The thought might be, you know, my mom's always interrupting my life. And that might create a similar feeling, but a whole different worksheet, because the goal involved there would be, I want my mother to, you know, treat me with integrity and support me. It might be, you know, that irritation might be, mom's always interrupting me. You know, right from when I was a child, I was in the middle of doing something, wanted to do something, and mom would just step right in and yank me out of the space. And what I wanted mom to do was to honor my choices. So that might be the goal that we work with. So the importance of really, and this is the skill set we're inviting people to do, is as opposed to denying and dissociating from this content, which most have done, you know, most of our generations previously, at least as far as we can tell, or I can tell, pretty much have kept that stuff in abeyance, have kept it in the dissociated mind. So learning to decode each of those thoughts so that we can tap into what's the goal that will bring the most powerful forgiveness result in this situation, and what you put in that blank in number three is key, and decoding the thought behind the neuropeptide. So, you know, if you look at the movie in Inside Out, all this sadness that's taken over Joy's life in the movie is resolved when she can tell the truth about her sadness, when she can speak the thought in the presence of love that her sadness was all about. And, you know, it's a really fine point in the movie, but if you remember, you know, she goes to her parents and she's in tears and she's like, you know, I had the goal. Mom actually framed the goal for her, and she said it earlier in the movie, you know, Dad's busy, so we're going to be Dad's perfect little girl, and we're not going to interrupt Daddy's need to work. And so she feels dissed, and that feeling of dissed is, and it looks like in the movie, it's like, I'm not important, and I'm not allowed to tell the truth about what I'm feeling or thinking. And the resolution comes when she's able to go to her parents, and of course they're holding the space of love, and she's able to tell the truth about the thoughts that created her sadness. I miss my home. I miss my friends. I miss being able to play hockey. And she's safe enough to do that instead of having to fulfill the goal that Mom framed for her of being the perfect little girl that doesn't interrupt Dad's day, doesn't interfere with his life.
Right.
That all fit and kind of give you the refinement you're looking for?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And the thought I had when Jeannie was explaining it was the first thought I had was, does every thought have a goal attached to it? And then that's exactly what you said. Your next sentence was, yeah, and every thought has a goal. And that's where I was getting, you know, if I look at the agitation emotion, okay, so I'm agitated, that had a gob of thoughts, and I'm thinking, okay, well, there's a lot of goals underneath my agitation. So I was, you know, and you hit a lot of them. I want my mom to respect me. I want her to have integrity. I want her to call first and ask if she can come over. I want to be honored. So all of those were in that whole thought train, like a lot of things firing off at the same time. So that really gets it clear to me. It's if every one of those has a neuropeptide, I really want to have all of those be transformed, you know, cancel that goal, get back to I honor my mother, I love my mother, I am the space of love in her presence. And, you know, there's nothing missing, nothing wrong. It's just timing and making requests and not having or having, instead of not having, having that peace that, you know, I'm in line with my divine source. I'm not, there's no conflict here except for what my brain is firing off these little challenges that I have. So that helps me kind of put it on the court, so to speak, and hear it in what's going on language. It always just helps me so much to have that language, like, okay, here's what's going on, and this is how you break it apart, because it gets me back to the goal and gets me present to any time I have fear, anger, pain, I'm the one. It's not happening over
what's
there. It's happening over here.
Exactly. What's driving my mind. And I liked that precise psychological language that used of that gob of thoughts. That's really, you know, right on track. And it that really explains why Yeshua said, now around this issue, you're probably going to do 77 times 70 worksheets, because there's a whole, you know, accumulation of mind energy that comes from, you know, maybe 1,000 experiences we've had with mom or authority figures. And that there were 1,000 experiences in my genes that mom had with her mom and authority figures and her mom had with, and all of those energetic dynamics contribute to the end result of what I call my perceptual construct, or the world I see that I think is out there that's really in here, and the necessity to collapse it in order to bring present love and to live out of that present love while those energetic dynamics that I've still not yet resolved move in me. And it's desirable to have them move because that's the only way we get to resolve them.
Right. Well, and I have to say that I've had a miracle, you know, with my mother. I mean, through this work, it's so different. I mean, how it used to be, you know, they say in AA, here's how it used to be. Here's what happened, and here's how it is now. So they're looking at saying, okay, before the 12 steps, I was a drunk and a blah, 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 blah. And after the 12 steps, I have, you know, or here's what happened. I lost my house, my car, my wife, and now here's where I am after having done the steps. And so it's like, that's how I feel about this work. It's like, here's how my relationship with my mother, how it was, constant conflict, constant irritation, kind of a train wreck, if you will, cancel universe, if we don't want any of those, but like that. And then what happened is I came to Heartland and I've been doing this work and she's like a completely different person. Isn't that interesting how she changed?
Yes. It is interesting how they change when we – and one of the things to recognize in that context is that everything that moves in us, every informational molecule that moves in us, let's say that when it strikes the cell creates frustration or irritation, literally as it's moving in us, that field moving sets up an energy wave that sprays on them. And when it sprays on them, it tends to reinforce the whole behavior pattern that set the thing up in the first place. And when we can become the one that interrupts the pattern inside of us, and in that situation that yesterday, literally because there had been irritation moving in me, I spare irritation on this person, who then, of course, responds to that irritation with some of their own. When I can forgive, remove that irritation, and make the choice to bring in the presence of love, then literally when love is moving in me, I'm spraying active love on them. And they're going to be different. And also, my perceptual construct, if it's coming out of brain cells filled with irritation, I'm going to have a certain perceptual construct that is going to be the filter through which I see them. And when I shift that content, I'm literally generating a whole different world that I see and overlay on them. And so as those both of those things shift and change, everything changes, and that's the beauty and the gift of this genius mind of Yeshua that said, here's how you forgive, folks. Here it is. And, yep, you might have to do it 77 times, 70 times, and the benefits will be just beyond comprehension.
It really is. We had supper together last night, and it was the most beautiful experience. And I got home, and it was like you know how when you have one of those remarkable, you have like a moment of clarity and you identify that it's no longer how it used to be and you're not even sure when it shifted or how it shifted or what happened, but how it used to be was for me to have dinner with my mother was quite an ordeal because I don't eat the way she eats and she would push me to try to eat. And when she wanted me to eat what she eats. So it would sometimes be quite, you know, a challenge. And, I mean,
so
it was like...
You might want to interrupt that thought.
Interrupt that thought.
Yeah. And if you look at what you just said, and it might be worth going back and just listening to the show again, you might want to catch the subtle denial involved.
What is it?
Okay. So as you described what you called an ordeal, something moving and happening inside of you, was happening because of what mom did.
Yes. Okay. Perfect.
And my offering is that the ordeal, whatever that means precisely, that sounds like a whole complex, another one of those gobs, whatever that ordeal was moving in you because it's in you, and Mom was the trigger for it. When I speak about I'm having this ordeal because of what Mom says or does, then I'm in denial. I'm thinking and speaking as though something outside of me is causing this inside of me. And when I
okay,
do that,
okay, I want help with this one.
Is
there somebody else waiting to call to talk on the
no,
the switchboard?
We don't need that. You're on. You're on. We got all the time you need. We're
okay,
here
good.
To support you. So,
so I want to get. I want to help with this because this has been. It mean what I said means I have not gotten over it. Like I'm still making it be her thing
just
in my head. So,
we're describing the way it used to be.
Yeah.
So you were saying when I used to have dinner with my mom. So it may be something resolved, but I was just pointing out for your sake and for the audience's sake, especially if there's somebody new that really hasn't gotten the subtlety of how denial works. So you were speaking in past tense, so it may be something that you have actually totally resolved already, but speaking in past tense, there was the denial of, you know, I had this ordeal because Mom, blah, 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 blah. And just to be aware, catch yourself, watch our language. You know, Shakespeare says, my words fly up, my thoughts remain below. If I keep watching my words will tell me when I'm hiding something. And I'm hiding something when I say, that out there caused this in here.
Okay, so that's what I want help with.
Work to do. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
so that out there caused this in here. So here's what used to happen that didn't happen last night. And I was when I got home, I had this epiphany like, wow, not one time did she do blah, blah, blah. So what she used to always do that I think is her, not me, still, I have that still in my brain. Like I noticed I'm saying ordeal, no. But yet I was surprised that it didn't happen. Pleasantly surprised, like
right.
An epiphany, but still it resonated with me when you said denial because I had this fear like I'm expecting it to go down, and I was surprised it didn't. So how it would
so
be
how about
would
mind
be
you?
Okay.
I'll remind you.
Go ahead.
So how about, I love it when I have dinner with my mom.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes to every extreme possible to bring up the ordeal in me. Ouch. There it is. There it is. That's the closing down of the energy field and the gift she gives you. So if you use that, you can artificially work through that one rather than having to create that circumstance again. And then you could go have dinner with Mom, and Mom could do all those behaviors, and because the ordeal's no longer in you, you can just sit there and be love and have a delightful time with Mom. And let
and
Mom
that
be
has
gone.
Been happening a lot, but then I could really yeah. hear when you said that, I was like, nah, it's not gone yet. Because, yeah, okay, good.
Yeah, well, that's the 77 times 70 times that Yeshua, you know, there are layers.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, you may be getting down to a genetic layer that maybe isn't even yours. And when we can access
listen, there's food issues on both sides all the way back, so it wouldn't surprise me if this is carbon-based memory major.
Right.
I mean, we got the Karen Carpenter disease going on everywhere. So, I mean, I'm probably, yeah, anyway, I don't want to say that. I'm
go
healing. I'm doing my healing work.
Awesome. Well, we're here holding the space for it. And
yeah.
the fact that you're doing your healing work is an awesome gift to us because you're refining your ability to ask the right questions. And with those questions, we all get to play with the answer. So thank you. It's awesome.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to get to work now.
All right. Enjoy that mind shifter. I'm sure you'll have fun with it.
Yeah, it's a good one. Thank you.
All right. Okay,
bye-bye.
By the way, for anybody that's new to the show, what is a mind shifter? A mind shifter is a tool that we use that allows you to kind of vicariously go through a situation without having to actually experience it. So what you do, you know, if that mind shifter is yours, you know, if you've got a similar situation going on with someone, the reason why you'd use such an insane thought as the one that I just gave to Tracy is that you can use that thought, and what you do is you take a page, a piece of paper, and split it down the middle, and on the left-hand side of the page, you write the thought, and then on the right-hand side of the page, you write everything that comes up in your mind in response to it. The human mind works by a law called the law of resonance, and the law of resonance, simply stated, goes like this. When two energy fields are in tune or in harmony with each other, there's an exchange of information between them. So if somebody comes along and resonates brain cells in me, then, and those brain cells contain pain, here I am waiting for that person to come along and bring up my pain. Whereas I can short-circuit the whole process by choosing a thought that will act like the stimulus in a real situation to resonate that part of my mind. Now, if I say, don't think about the color of your car, what resonates in brain cells? So when I take a thought like that, like, for instance, in our Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing workshop, I always use the same example because it opens a space for people who have money issues, which is most everybody. And the one I use is, I always earn twice as much as I can spend. And most people's response to that is, who are you trying to kid? Are you crazy? That's baloney. And then you write, my shifter again, I always earn twice as much as I can spend. But that's crazy. I've never been able to pay my bills. In fact, they're threatening to take away my car. Are you breathing? No. Well, take a breath. Breathe and write the mind shifter again. I always earn twice as much as I can spend. But that's ridiculous. I can remember as a kid, you know, I mean, our family's never had enough money. We've always been in poverty. I always earn twice as much as I can spend. God, you know, that's so crazy that there was so much trauma in our lives. I can remember, God, I remember Mom and Dad and that big fight they had. And, you know, it was all over money. And Dad walked out the door and I never saw him again. Bingo. Core issue resonated and brought to the surface with the opportunity to work through it by allowing or artificially setting up a vibration that matches what you know you need to deal with, and it unpacks or resonates or opens up that neuropeptide that contains that thought that when it strikes the cell generates so much pain. And when it opens up, you get a chance to bring love to it and change it. And now that the thought's changed, that pain is gone. You're freed from it. And that's how forgiveness works. So it opens a space for those things to move and be resolved within and not having to go out into the world and, you know, create the circumstance for it to happen. And if you don't do your work, you know, the purpose of the world, the way the Creator set the world up, it seems, through resonance, with this genius piece of information, resonance, and that everything we hold in us is an energy moving in us that sets up a field, that it's set up to kick you in the limitation. If there's a disease energy in you, if there's something that's creating a limitation on your ability to function as the presence of love and consciously create your life, life is going to, because of this resonance, deliver someone who's going to do a behavior that kind of acts like a mind shifter. But you can do it a whole lot easier to just recognize, okay, I'm going to use a mind shifter to work through that one. I'm not going to wait for somebody to come along and kick me in that limitation again. Like, you know, I've had enough of that one. So it's a powerful, wonderful thing to have some tools to short-circuit the process of healing and open up the space to really recognize who we are as love and function out of that. And we're down to the last minute or so I'm just going to invite you once again, if you're in the Asheville, North Carolina area, we'll be at Unity.